On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk a bit about the importance of securing machine-to-machine communication, especially for medical devices, a bit about Microsoft Graph, and we have Christopher Kelly on to talk about the history of our surveillance society. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 244, recorded June 16th, 2017. Look, Mom, I'm on CCTV.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open source, you can download and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. And literally by Sonic, Twit's 10-gig fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free.
Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of the enterprise. But let's face it, folks, the enterprise is a pretty big place. It's so big that large retailers and cloud service providers are buying organic grocery stores. It's so big, I can't actually discuss it by myself. I need to bring in another pro, and of course, the brains of this operation, my co-host, Mr. Brian Chi. He's the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. And right now, he's a little busy dealing with some power issues down there in paradise. Chibert, have you overcome the darkness yet?
We have overcome the darkness. Just real quick summary. The transformers in my building blew up the other day, and we've been in the dark for a while. Light came back yesterday about 4 p.m. Hawaii Standard Time, and we are on a temporary set of transformers. It is all hope that once the transformers are replaced, that life will become a lot more stable. But I'm doing the broadcast from home today because the network is still down. But we're working on that. But anyway, off to the races.
Off to the races, yeah, absolutely. So it's just the two of us today. But you know, those of people who are actually interested in history and want to learn a little bit about the evolution of surveillance and our society, and a little bit how it actually evolved over time since the past, you want to go ahead and stay tuned to our guest later. But first, we were going to talk a little bit about IoT device hacking, specifically around medical devices, and discuss a little bit about my move in Microsoft just recently and how and what they're doing for developers and organizations. But first, as we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. As more and more documents are declassified over time, we learn more and more how far the reach of the government can go. What we do know, since the recently declassified Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court ruling documents came out, even though it was severely redacted, is that an unnamed technology company refused to comply with the orders to let the NSA spy on its client users. The release of the document was thanks to the ACLU Freedom of Information Act. Specifically, the mysterious company didn't comply with an NSA order under Section 702. That's the legal structure supporting the PRISM domestic spying program, which forces companies to give the NSA access to Americans' international communications. How did the company defend itself? Well, it said complying with the NSA would implicate its Fourth and First Amendment rights. The company essentially wanted to take the NSA to constitutional school on how legal the Section 702 was. In the end, Judge Rosemary Colyar ruled and rejected the company's claim and ordered it to comply with the NSA request. Section 702 is set to expire at the end of this year, and debate rages on about whether Congress should renew it.
Well, sadly, Xerox luminary and co-inventor of Ethernet just passed away. Charles Thacker was a luminary at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, aka PARC, and is credited with a large part of the design of the Xerox Alto, which supposedly influenced the Apple Mac and with Robert Metcalfe and others invented Ethernet. His passing is especially sad since he influenced many advanced ideas like resizable windows, the mouse, Ethernet, and many, many other ideas way ahead of their time. So even though Ethernet was based upon work done at the University of Hawaii's AlohaNet project, Mr. Thacker and Metcalf successfully took a pie-in-the-sky DARPA project and made it into a commercial success. His light will be sorely missed.
Absolutely. Apptio, who helps IT businesses run more efficiently by helping them operationalize budgeting and forecasting, also manage product build and run costs, set unit prices with forecasting costs and volume, and other facets of their business, also has access to a rich set of industry data due to the nature of their business. Since Apptio helps CIOs understand spending within their IT departments, it also has an inside look on how companies shift their back-end infrastructure from on-premise to cloud. Gupta, the CEO, helps us understand information from what they have and helps us understand spending in the IT departments as they look on the inside of the company. He basically says that noted 76% of customers are using Amazon Web Services, while 52% are using Microsoft Azure platform. He also is quoted on saying, "We've seen a quite rise in Azure usage. The data alone, because it's also aligning with recent numbers from Synergy Research Group, which shows AWS maintaining more than 40% of market share amid a big jump in the overall size of the market, while Microsoft is seeing a strong growth with Azure." Another interesting stat was that 29% of customers are actually managing multiple cloud environments. Many companies like the flexibility of being able to actually use two different or multiple different cloud services, which also make a competitive comparison more difficult. This also goes on noting, saying that smaller companies tend to stick with just one cloud offering, but didn't know actually which ones are doing that and which cloud services they're using. The digital transformation has begun, and the competition will stay fierce for quite some time.
Woohoo! No more boarding passes. Just give TSA the finger. The Transportation Security Administration said Tuesday it's testing a new checkpoint screening technology that matches fingerprints provided at the checkpoint with those already on file for travelers enrolled in the agency's pre-check program. The program allows low-risk travelers to go through expedited screening instead of waiting in regular security lines. The TSA said the technology has the potential to automate the check-in process by eliminating the need to check passengers' boarding passes and identification, granting travelers access to the airport's secured area through an electronic gate. TSA looks at technologies and intelligence capabilities that allow us to analyze and secure the travel environment, passengers, and their property, said Steve Carrelly of the TSA in a recent statement. He is the TSA's acting assistant administrator of requirements and capabilities analysis. Though these and other technology demonstrations were looking at reinventing and enhancing security effectiveness to meet the evolving threat and ensure that passengers get to their destination safely, is one of his statements. So while it's just a test at the moment, you could possibly check in by just giving TSA the finger.
You remember Maluba, the company that won the TechCrunch 2012 Startup Battlefield competition by displaying examples of its ability to use natural language processing and machine learning to try to achieve artificial general intelligence. Maluba was later acquired by Microsoft this past January and continues to debut deep learning examples of what's possible by machine learning. Well, sorry, people. Maluba is at it again, and now it's ruining our video games. At long last, the perfect score for arcade classic Ms. Pac-Man has been achieved by creating an AI system that's learned how to reach the game's maximum point value of 999,900 on the Atari 2600 using a unique combination of reinforcing learning with a divide and conquer method. Back in 2015, Google's DeepMind AI was able to learn how to master 49 Atari games using reinforced learning, which provides a positive or negative feedback each time the AI attempts to solve a problem. Ms. Pac-Man has always remained elusive for years due to the game's intentional lack of predictability. Until now, Maluba was able to use an AI to beat the game by tasking out the responsibilities, breaking it up into bite-sized jobs, and assigning it to over 150 different agents. If your favorite video game from the past isn't safe with machine learning, nothing is.
Well, even Windows XP gets an update this Tuesday as Microsoft steps up its bug squishing. Microsoft regularly issues security updates, but it added a little something extra on Tuesday. It's letting all customers, even those using older versions of Windows, to update their software. This move is an attempt to avoid another ransomware outbreak like WannaCry, also called WannaCrypt, which rocked the web last month. The WannaCrypt ransomware served as an all-too-real example of the danger of cyber attacks to individuals and businesses globally, Adrian Hall, general manager of Microsoft's Cyber Defense Operations Center, wrote in a blog post. In reviewing the updates for this month, some vulnerabilities were identified that pose elevated risk of cyber attacks by government organizations, sometimes referred to as nation-state actors or other copycat organizations. Microsoft said it made the decision to apply this assortment of updates to provide further protection against potential attacks with similar characteristics as WannaCrypt. The security updates will be delivered automatically through Windows Update to devices running Windows 10, 8.1, and Windows 7. To the Microsoft Windows updating team, I would like to express my sincerest gratitude for helping stomp out bugs like WannaCry.
Well, the day has finally come that Netflix has planned to participate in the internet-wide day of action to save net neutrality, which is actually posted for July 12th. Multiple companies like Amazon and Reddit have been on board since the beginning of the Save Net Neutrality Day. Netflix has been a lagger. Why? Well, Netflix's CEO puts it simply that net neutrality rules have become less important to Netflix because we're big enough to get the deals we want, and the time has come for smaller companies to lead the way. With its change in heart, Netflix has tweeted, "Netflix will never outgrow the fight for net neutrality. Everyone deserves an open internet. Let's hope the organized day has some sort of impact on the decisions at hand." Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to get into the bites, and we have a couple fun ones, actually. But first, we couldn't do this week in Enterprise Tech without the support of our sponsors, and this one is no exception. Padre?
Thanks, guys. We'll get right back to the action, but first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I'd like to talk to the developers out there, because you understand the pressures of a 24/7 environment. You have to deploy, you have to get the latest build out there, but at the same time, you need accuracy, you need consistency, and you need to make sure that you cover your tail. Well, folks, there's no better way to do that than with GoCD. Now, GoCD is the easiest way to configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment with its parallel and sequential execution. In other words, it offers complete customization for your software's individual needs, letting the tool conform to your process rather than the other way around. GoCD's real power is in the visibility it provides over your end-to-end workflow, so you get complete control of and visibility into all of your deployments across the organization. It will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks, and their test reporting is so thorough that it won't just tell you that your build failed a test, it will tell you in exactly which chain set and on which platform a test started to break. That means you can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. A GoCD is also fantastically flexible. It lets you delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges so that you can mete out the responsibilities as necessary. It also has extension points that let you connect any of a number of ready plugins or plugins that you write for yourself. The TLDR is you can say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. Folks, GoCD is an open source solution that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks, Padre. So let's go ahead and move into the bites. This is actually an interesting one and a bit scary for any person who wears or needs modern day medical devices. We've talked about this topic with some of our previous guests in the past and how some of the devices don't actually need to be connected to the internet. Does our CPAP machines or juicers or thermometers really need to be connected to the information superhighway? Well, back in episode 223, we talked about how St. Jude Medical patched their pacemakers, causing a vulnerability that was later reported by researchers at MedSec Holdings, and the public was ultimately warned by the Homeland Security Department. The transmitter in question sends data back to the medical professionals, and it was actually exploited. Security researchers firm Whitescope recently conducted research and found similarities amongst multiple of the pacemaker devices. One similarity was that all the devices were connected with external monitoring devices, which send medical data back to doctors. And second, all the devices had the ability for doctors to adjust and reprogram the devices with just adjusting some of the purposes. With their research, they found that after reviewing 7 pacemaker products from 4 different vendors, they were able to find 10 security vulnerabilities that most of them shared, and then also found that from the components that they're actually made up of, basically included 8,600 security flaws. So some of their issues that they found were, one, the monitoring device or management device, if it was stolen, someone could use it to connect to any pacemaker the manufacturer supported due to a universal authentication token, allowing for someone to actually connect and receive data, block data back and forth from the device, from pretty much any device as soon as they connect to it. That's the most disturbing part, because not only does it allow you to get data, it also allows you potentially reprogram the device, and which could cause harm and or kill a person. Another issue was that researchers found pacemakers don't actually block unnecessary adjustments. So certain facets of the pacemaker really shouldn't be able to be adjusted in any way. Like, for instance, shutting it down. They should essentially be whitelisting that functionality and only allowing certain necessary functions to be adjusted. Another big issue was the pacemaker systems actually have little to no authentication in this built into the system. So when connecting to the device, doctors actually could do it without even entering a password. So I guess this kind of points out one particular thing. Cheaper, what do you think? Do we really need devices, especially things like this, to be actually connected to the internet? Because, you know, closed circuit communication and other techniques have been used for pretty much many years in the past for devices where, you know, you didn't actually need to be connected to the internet. Where should we be limiting this?
I do have a little bit of experience. I was put on a Holter monitor for a little while, so because they suspected I might have had an increased problem with a heart valve. And so I had a conversation with the cardiologist. And he says, yeah, it's not perfect. Things change under different conditions, and that's why they need this constant feedback loop. You know, they'll look at the EKG off the pacemaker itself and see what the heck is going on, and then they like to be able to send adjustments, and they don't want to have to wait until the next time the patient comes back into the office. Now, my bone of contention with this is a lot of these companies are just using off-the-shelf toolkits. Think of it as, you know, someone taking out Lego and not really understanding how the pieces really fit together. You know, maybe it's not strong enough or things like that, you know, if we're going to use the Lego analogy. Well, the companies that are building this aren't really understanding the security features of the toolkits, and they're just kind of slapping them together, which tells me that maybe, just maybe, they might want to consider stop being so cheap and hire some real programmers that have some security experience. Right, JJ? You know, I know JJ is looking for a job. And the reality is that is an industry trend that I'm seeing over and over and over again. I see it in a lot of Internet of Things. I see it in power management. I see it in a lot of different little devices that people put out. We definitely saw that in webcams. So I think maybe, just maybe, as much as I hate the concept, the world started making CPAs have to go for certification. Maybe it's time we start thinking about the same thing for programmers before they're allowed to work on anything that's life-threatening. What do you think, Lou?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting part. I mean, you pointed out a lot of the parts that they're using, they're just, like you said, off the shelf. You can get them anywhere. You can buy them on eBay if you wanted to. You can buy them in the parts stores. And it's a huge process to kind of put these things together. You would think that medical devices, I don't know, are there specific type of certification processes, especially for medical devices that are connected to networks?
Well, as far as I know, the devices themselves have to be certified by the FDA. But just like everybody thinks that the HIPAA regulations specify what kinds of firewalls and things you have to use, or you know, PCI for credit card? No. All it says is, you know, an industry acceptable level of protection is basically what it says. And the unfortunate thing is the entire industry has not set minimal standards. Like, for instance, anyone can say that they're producing an enterprise grade firewall. And the reality is a lot of those enterprise grade firewalls, when I did testing for InfoWorld a long, long time ago, couldn't stop even the standard catalog of cert attacks. And that was only from the outside. The second I turned it inside out, say like someone had an infection from a kid's laptop that went into a corporation, so an inside attack, a lot of these enterprise grade firewalls were like tissue paper with attacks from the inside. The same kind of thing is happening with a lot of these medical devices. They're concentrate on the medicine, which, God bless them, that's what they really should be. But they really and truly need to bring in security specialists as part of the design process, because the security on a lot of these devices is tissue paper. You know, just look, you know, go into any kind of cardiac monitor, and anyone that's even just reasonably good at, say, a toolkit like Metasploit can break into that cardiac monitoring device. It's too easy. And so when you start putting it up against nation state actors, you know, we don't have a chance. So congressional leaders, a lot of you guys have pacemakers. What happens if a nation state decides to go and cause every single member of Congress that has a pacemaker to have a heart attack during session? Think about that for a while. And absolutely. Why don't we start thinking about building some better standards for medical security devices?
Yeah, I agree. I think just recently I was reading a paper, you know, I do a lot of IoT work with my son outside of work, and you know, just recently, Nokia actually published a paper on what they call machine-to-machine communication. And essentially, it outlines really some interesting principles that manufacturers should be taking to secure the devices, as well as just the communication between the devices. So, for instance, some of the points that they point out is that the devices need a secure or immutable identity. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the identity of the device can't change because it's burned into the hardware of the device. So, for instance, an IMEI in a phone or a VIN on a car or something that actually identifies the device in a secure way, either software or hardware based, and a token, for instance, like stores keys and certificates securely on the device. So, an example would be that universal integrated circuit, like a smart card or a chipset that Intel has identity protection. Also, there's a software base where basically digital certs can be secured as immutable key storage. So second in their document, it also talks about how devices require or should require secure communication channels for management. So obviously we know what that means. It means that management of the services or gateways that actually talk to the device need to basically ensure confidentiality of the data going between the two and the integrity of the data. And the way they can do that is using encryption standards like HTTP and LTLS. Also, between non-cellular devices and gateways, DTLS can be used to pre-share keys or use tokens or X509 public keys or raw public keys to ensure data confidentiality of communication. And third, they actually call out that the devices need trusted software environment. And that means that the low-level packages like the firmware needs to be secured, and it needs to be in an immutable device identifier in order to ensure that when it's actually communicating the data and actually updating the firmware, it's done in a more secure way. And it upholds the kind of the device, the gateway integrity, and it can also secure the digest or hash algorithm by using that. And it secures it and can be used to ensure that the transmitted data is actually not tampered with. And finally, they call out device availability. And that means that the device and its gateway should be protected from its malicious activity. Like, for instance, it should protect itself from DDoS attacks. So, like, for instance, when the management server gateways can collaborate, there's continuous monitoring. So, for instance, there's alarms and alerts. This way they have the ability to shut down the device and or the gateway to prevent malicious devices from affecting the network. And, of course, triggering proactive actions to correct the problem system-wide. So, and they also call out something interesting, and I've never heard this before, but they also call out some standards that are actually out there for machine-to-machine devices from the Open Mobile Alliance. For instance, they have a specification called the Device Management Specification, which basically enables protocols for creating secure communication channels. Also, they talk about gateway management and device classification and also how to use lightweight protocols for smaller devices like sensors and actuators and controllers. So, I mean, Chibert, is this something that we should be pushing? Is these more towards standards and then also certifying these standards as these devices come out? I think we've talked about it before.
Yeah, it's there's been lots of conversations about this type of thing. I've certainly heard the National Institute of Standards and Technology talking about this. The power industry has certainly talked about this. Just look inside any major organization that has desktop computers and just take a good hard look. How many TPM devices are actually enabled on those desktops? I would say very few. And the other thing is, you know, look at UEFA instead of a BIOS, where you put digital signatures on the hard drives. Right. It's going to be a long, rocky road to get these standards adopted. And as much as I hate government oversight in my industry, because I think we've done pretty good by ourselves, I think this might be someplace where the industry needs kind of a push from Congress. Maybe, I don't know, you know, I hate saying that, but, you know, we need some sort of impetus, some sort of push to get more secure machine-to-machine communication, because it sooner or later it's going to cost us some lives.
Agreed. Well, folks, I think we've kind of beat that one to the down. So let's move on to the next point. And this one's a little bit closer to home to me. So this past Monday, I made a pretty big leap in my career. I started at Microsoft about 14 years ago in the Great Plains group, and I got to grow and know many, many passionate, knowledgeable engineers, and I've had pretty much a pretty good amount of impact on small to medium to enterprise sized businesses. And I had the fortunate enough time to work with products that not only had deep roots, but also had multiple generations of clients and platforms and moving to the cloud. And for the past 7 years, I've been on the Dynamics CRM group. But this past Monday, I decided to take a leap in my career and move out into another place in the business that hits a little closer to not only the enterprise, but commercial, but also education and consumers as well. As part of my shift, I'll be owning the Microsoft Graph SDKs, as well as part of the greater Office Developer Experience Group initiatives. So I've been transitioning this week, and I've been pretty much amazed at the amount of technology and services that are actually out there and possible for people to use, and most likely they have no idea that it exists. So one thing is, for instance, Chibert, have you heard of the Microsoft or Office Graph before?
Sure, it's what you use in Microsoft Excel. Oh, there's more? Really? Okay, no, I didn't.
That's right. So it's interesting because people hear graph and they think about other things. It used to be called Office Graph, but now it actually includes a ton of other Microsoft assets. And essentially, the graph is just a standardized API endpoint for accessing data in the Microsoft Cloud, both consumer and commercial organizations, and includes data from pretty much all the family of products as part of the Microsoft Cloud services. It allows you to interact with the services using simple URLs like me or groups/me/groups to interact with the graph centered around people, organizations, and activities. So for instance, you can get your user profile information or other people's user profile information from Azure AD. You can get your calendar and messages coming from Exchange, soon have a Dynamics in there. So think of it like for many years, multiple organizations out there have provided their own kind of APIs and SDKs that have their own schema. So you can call this one over here and this one over there. And they were kind of siloed and isolated. But the graph solves this by providing just one single simple API that allows you to access all the data at once. So essentially, it's like saying that this is the API for Microsoft. It's a single place to sign on, and it consolidates all the APIs down to a single interface. So to me, it's very powerful, because as a developer and I worked in the IT business before, I know that it's very hard to go acquire information both from this system over here and that system over here. Have to write different pieces of code to do that. Cheebert, have you used APIs in the past to get information? It's not always easy to call these tons of systems just to aggregate it together and make sense out of it, don't you think?
I'm going to show my age here. The last set of Microsoft APIs that I used was actually using it was the Office APIs in combination with the Attachmate 3270 toolkit, and using Visual Basic and Microsoft Access and then Microsoft SQL, we were able to actually screen scrape off TN3270 sessions into the IBM mainframe at the University of Hawaii, so that even though the primary student information system was actually based on CICS, old mainframe stuff, you know, as the data was actually in 80 column card images, for God's sakes, we were able to screen scrape that off TN3270 to create a touch tone and web registration system. So I'm familiar with the Office API set, and it's a very, very rich thing that's extended by a couple of different corporations. But, you know, truthfully, I didn't even realize that Graph was such a rich environment until Lou and I started talking about this at Enterprise Byte.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting, because this, again, like I said, I've worked in many systems before, and just being able to acquire data from different systems is just, it's a pain in the neck, and it causes a lot of time. So for instance, what this image is actually showing is the graph allows pretty much what they call three main themes. One, getting data. So like, for instance, what documents people are working on, what you're working on, what appointments they have, whether other interesting documents other people are reading. It also allows you to traverse data, or like essentially step through data. Which they call walking the graph, which is particular, like, for instance, like on OneDrive, when somebody last edited something, by whom was it edited, find out where they work, who their manager is, and other documents they might have edited and find it interesting. So like, that's kind of the way of going really deep down to the graph that you wouldn't be able to do just by calling one API. You'd have to call multiple different places. And so this particular, the graph actually allows you to call it once and actually acquire all that data just by walking the graph. And of course, the third theme is accessing insights or intelligence. And so essentially, they're using machine learning to allow you to create models and determine what's trending around a topic or a particular document, and then it allows you to query it. So that's the interesting thing is, you know, and I'm sure, Cheebert, you've used Active Directory before, right? Or maybe Intune, any of those?
Just using the Microsoft tools. I've never really touched their APIs.
Okay. So, I mean, like Active Directory, you know, you want to be able to query identities and information about that entity. But for instance, like the original graph was more of around a productivity thing. So it allowed you to access the properties like Excel and Outlook. But it's been expanded to more of a scope around Microsoft itself. For instance, it does allow you to do Excel and access workbooks and worksheets and tables and charts. It allows you to do the Excel calc engine and call functions, but also allows you OneDrive, which is, there's a pretty cool feature for consumers in OneDrive part of it, where it's called app folders. It allows you to essentially have a home for all your users, for you to store your personal files without cluttering up your OneDrive folder. And also there's some new data sets. SharePoint had just GA'd recently around SharePoint sites. Planner APIs, I don't know if you've used Planner before, but allows you to create plans and tasks. And also OneNote API allows you to interact with notebooks and notes and pages and sections. There's also a new one from the Windows team called Project Roam, which is essentially allows you to seamlessly have an experience across your devices. So you not only have a smooth experience around activities, being able to capture when I'm watching a video over here and I'm having a worker file over here and I want to transfer it and continue my work on another device, and you kind of have that seamless transition between the two. That's what Project Roam is all about, and it's not only connected from a device-to-device standpoint, but it's also connected to the graph. And of course, Intune is another one, which allows you to manage your devices through a developer interface. So there's a ton of stuff coming out, and that's why just this opportunity kind of be able to go there. Now, I also put a link in the doc about this, what they call the Graph Explorer. So being able to get started, they have this cool Graph Explorer that you can go to. And Kevin, do you want to show it? Essentially, it's just like you can click on the APIs to the left, and it lets you essentially call out to different things, just demoing the data that actually returns. So for instance, my photo or my information, that kind of thing. It allows you to do any normal HTTP verbs like get, patch, post, put, delete. And you can use a demo account, or you can sign in and use your either Microsoft account or your Office 365 account to get actual real data. They have developer programs. So if you want to sign up for Office 365 as a preview, you could do that. It allows you a 25-user tenant. And they also have a huge developer community, and they use things like UserVoice, so aka.ms/graph UserVoice, if you want to check that out. And of course, Microsoft Graph Tag on Stack Overflow. And of course, check out all the SDKs, and that's the stuff that my team's directly supporting. And it supports .NET, JavaScript, PHP, Android, iOS, Ruby, Python. I can keep going on and on. And of course, you can get there at aka.ms/msgraphSDK. So that's pretty much it. That's my new gig, and look out for some of the new stuff that's coming from that area. So when we come back, I'm excited about our guest and just how much info he can give us on the history of surveillance in our country. But first, we couldn't just do This Week in Enterprise Tech without the support of our sponsors, and this one is no exception. Padre?
We'll get back to the action, but first, let's take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And this sponsor I'm very proud to have because they're trying to make the internet a better place. Of course, I'm talking about Sonic. This Week in Enterprise Tech is literally brought to you by Sonic. They're our 10 gig fiber internet service provider. Now, the internet infrastructure in the United States needs fixing. We know that. There are too many people paying far too much for unsatisfactory cable internet. Sonic tries to fix that by delivering fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Their mission is to bring internet freedom to all with unlimited and uncapped internet. They deliver residential and business fiber to the premise networks with gigabit connectivity in San Francisco, the North Bay, and the East Bay area. Their internet service includes 15 email accounts and 1 gigabyte of storage, personal web hosting with a no domain, and fax line service. And that's from only $40 a month. That's right, Sonic offers download speeds of up to 1,000 megabits per second for one low, low price. Now, a home phone connection with unlimited local and long distance calling is included in all of their service. And switching from your current carrier is easy. You can keep your existing phone number. Now, by standing up for privacy, and this is important, folks, by standing up for privacy, friendly, and local customer support, uncapped bandwidth, and affordable pricing for all of their products, Sonic's customer advocacy is paving the way for a better state of the internet in America. If you are tired of your, well, lousy service, if you're tired of paying high prices, then you need to join the internet revolution. Visit sonic.com/twit. Receive your first month of Sonic internet and phone service for free. Plus, bundle with Dish and save $120 off your Sonic bill. Visit sonic.com/twit. That's sonic.com/twit. And we thank Sonic for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks, Padre. Well, let's go ahead and get into my favorite part of the show, where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today's guest is pretty much no exception. Originally from Sacramento, California, with a BA in philosophy from UC Berkeley, and someone who's worked pretty much 20 years in the television industry, our guest has always had a passion for history, and especially military history. He lives in London, but also here in Seattle for some time. Welcome to the show, Mr. Christopher Kelly. Christopher, thank you so much for coming to the show.
Lou, great to be with you today.
Really appreciate it. So now, you know, just as Christopher has a passion for history, so does Cheebert. Cheebert, domestic surveillance intended to protect American citizens, has been pretty much the fabric of America life for almost more than 100 years. But with the recent NSA leaks, the intelligence gathering programs revealed by Edward Snowden are really unprecedented in how deep they go and their use of advanced technologies and in the legal foundation that the foreign intelligence surveillance offered them. Cheebert, is this time for us to take a step back and learn just how far back in history this goes?
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of the concept of if we do not recognize what history has come before us, we are destined to relive history. I'm not sure if I got that quote correct, but the reality is there's we're making some of the same mistakes over and over again. And this is one of the big reasons when I saw the press release from Mr. Kelly's press agent, I go, wow, what an opportunity. You know, I like talking to historians because they give me such a great view of where we're going. I see things happening over and over again. As an ex federal employee working with cryptography and unfortunately also with surveillance, there was times I was really questioning, you know, whether or not what I was doing obviously was legal, but was it ethical? Should I have been doing it? And Mr. Kelly's going to give us a really nice step back in time so we can go and take a historical perspective on surveillance. And, you know, I've talked too much. Let's go give Mr. Kelly the soapbox.
Brian, great to be with you. And yes, I mean, I think it is important for us to study history. History doesn't always repeat itself, but it often rhymes. There definitely tend to be patterns in history and historical experience that we can study history and maybe learn from that experience. There we go with it. And I think that's really right. Mark Twain is right on target there. So it's important for us to understand their past. And we do have, I mean, you worked in surveillance yourself, but I mean, this is what I think that many people may not realize is that this has been going on for a very long time. I mean, this year, 2017, marks the 100th anniversary of the start of American involvement in World War I. And that was in part brought about as a result of the Zimmerman telegram, which was a telegram between the German ambassador in Washington, D.C. and his counterpart in Mexico City that was intercepted by the British. And they had an entity called Room 40 of the Admiralty, and their business was to intercept radio messages and to pass them on when they had a use for political purposes. And, I mean, today people are very excited about, you know, the politics and, you know, what's been involved with the Russians and did the Russians influence our election and so forth. And that's a big deal today. But, you know, they may not realize that in 1917, to some extent, when the world was in a world war, which was, if you will, a death grapple between the British Empire and the German Empire, I mean, both intelligence services were using all means at their disposal to try to win that war. I mean, the Germans famously sent Ilyich Lenin to Russia to start the Bolshevik Revolution and to basically take one player out of that war. But the British were monitoring this activity by the Germans and then relayed that to Americans and used that to help to influence America's entry on the side of the Allies in World War I. So, I mean, this surveillance has been going on for a very long time indeed.
You know, Chris, the intelligence services have grown over the years. You know, obviously, you live in London. London is being touted as the most surveilled city on earth. And, you know, it's been both useful and not useful. I don't know. Box Command is the eye in the sky. It's the God view of London. And there's been a lot of people debating just how much freedom Londoners have given up in exchange for being such a metropolitan city with, unfortunately, so much terrorism.
Right.
And, you know, where did this come from? How did the UK start on this slippery slope?
Well, I mean, it's true that the UK does have a tremendous amount of surveillance going on with CCTV. You have more CCTV, I think, in the UK than in the rest of the world combined, I believe. And, I mean, you can't walk around London without being recorded, you know, in any kind of public space. And this is not, you know, and for instance, they have developed the CCTV to the point that somebody who is, you know, out littering in public, the CCTV can address them with a loudspeaker that says, pick up that trash. And I mean, to do things like that. So you have, you know, this kind of interactivity on a scale that there that and of course the question is, does it work? Well, it often works, you know, after the fact. They're able to discover their intelligence after the fact, but they aren't, of course, able to do things like prevent the Manchester attack that took place recently that killed, I believe, 22 people. And they aren't able to prevent an attack, but hopefully they're able to solve the problem. I mean, just recently you had this terrible fire in London, which apparently has claimed over 100 lives. And, you know, will they from CCTV be able to discern something about the fire? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that there are people working on it very hard right now as we speak.
So should we be drawing a line? I think that's the question a lot of people are asking. Has the UK gone over that line? And is the United States about to follow the UK in the same right. path? You know, especially with how the NSA is doing all this filtering in their big giant data center in Utah.
Right. Well, I mean, here's another example in the UK. I mean, that they're able to use CCTV to monitor to see whether kids are showing up for school or walking their path from home to school on time, or are they playing? In other words, to enforce hooky rules in school. And, you know, I think there's a real question whether, you know, enforcing, you know, school attendance through CCTV is going too far. I mean, to me, that seems like a bit of an overreach. But, you know, I don't know what your thoughts on that might be.
Well, I'm worried. With artificial intelligence, you know, with Deep Blue and so forth, really starting to do some large amounts of progress in pattern recognition and so forth. You know, some of the folks in the chat room mentioned this sounds like Person of Interest, that TV show where you had this artificial intelligence that could go and start predicting when murders were going to happen. You know, mm-hmm. this is very much an Orwellian society that's starting to come true. You know, George Orwell missed it a little bit. He predicted 1984. Well, it's 2017. And I'm starting to feel like I might be growing old in an Orwellian society. What do you think, Chris? How accurate was George?
Well, I mean, I think Orwell to me is a great hero. I mean, he was, you know, Eric Blair, and George Orwell was his pen name, and he was wounded during the Spanish Civil War, shot through the lungs, nearly died as a result of, you know, of his ideological beliefs. I mean, he joined the Republican side in the fight against fascism early on, before World War II, of course, and of course he predicted lots of things with Big Brother in 1984, and Animal Farm, and all the rest of it. So I think he was an amazingly gifted writer and had amazing foresight into kind of what was coming down the pike. I mean, Animal Farm, he wrote, it was published in August of 1945, in this, almost the same month that the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And in a sense, this was a literary bomb that was dropped, that Orwell dropped with the publication of Animal Farm, which was a kind of a ringing denunciation of the Stalinist tyranny in the Soviet Union, with coming from a guy who was definitely strongly identified with the left prior to that.
So, Chris, there was a statement back in 1970 by the Senate Church Committee when it was held hearings on the activities of the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. And it said that about the National Security Agency, that to violate the privacy of American citizens is unmatched by any other intelligence agency. Do you think that this kind of holds true today, especially, you know, as we talk about some of the other government agencies in other countries as well?
Well, I mean, I think that you have a wiring, a balance that has to be kept between security and freedom. I think that the two are not necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, but in fact, go pretty much hand in hand. But the balance has to be right. I mean, that you can't. I mean, obviously, we do not want to turn, you know, our nation and the West into a police state and to abandon all of our freedoms, freedom of expression, the freedoms that we hold dear and liberties that we cherish. So we don't want to become a police state. But at the same time, there are threats to our existential, you know, state, right? I mean, that there are threats to our existence, I'm afraid. So, and we've experienced that, you know, numerous times over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, from the 9/11 attacks to what happened in Manchester to, you know, I mean, you name it. So there are existential threats out there. There is, of course, a need for privacy, but I mean, there also has been this surveillance that's been going on for a very long time. Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of State under FDR, in his memoirs wrote a line. He said that gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail. But I mean, that is kind of, you know, was interesting, but is obviously, you know, not true. And during World War II, there was a great deal of surveillance going on with code breaking and listening in on the Axis radio traffic that was really very important. I mean, Eisenhower estimated that it may have shortened the war by at least a year and saved, you know, millions of lives.
Right. Another thing, interesting thing I wanted to ask you, I know you've talked about, especially in many of your books, about some pivotal points in history. And, you know, one pivotal point, and I wonder what you get your thoughts on this, is do you think that events like the Edward Snowden leaks are pivotal points in modern day security and privacy rights? Or do you think that, you know, this has happened in the past and it hasn't really altered anything?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, yes, the Snowden incident was, you know, I think a seminal case, but it isn't, you know, without precedent. You have, you know, other instances where, I mean, Guglielmo Marconi was the, of course, the inventor of radio. And the very first radio transmission that went across the Atlantic took place in December of 1902. And really, since that point in time, governments have been very interested in what is going back and forth on those radio traffic intercepts, whether it's a governmental transmission or whether it's a private citizen. There's obviously been a flurry and an exponential increase in the amount of traffic that goes out there electronically, because everybody and his brother, you know, has a device these days. Which just means that the governments have had to work harder to kind of, you know, monitor successfully what's out there.
Hey, Chris, this has been kind of tickling the back of my mind. There's been a lot of conversations about a national ID, and I get this flashback, you know, from the history books about the Stasi in East Berlin. You know?
Yes.
You know, what should we really be looking for?
There was a great movie about the East Germany. I'm forgetting the title of it, but it was all about monitoring, the Stasi monitoring of a writer in, I believe it was a writer in East Germany. And very, very well made movie about that whole situation. Of course, the Stasi was very much interested in monitoring people's, you know, what I mean, they were bugging everybody's people's rooms and living quarters. And I mean, this is something that, you know, shaped the consciousness of somebody like Angela Merkel of Germany, the Chancellor of Germany, who of course grew up in East Germany and had to deal with the Stasi on a regular basis.
Chris, you know, unfortunately, we've run out of time. So that was Christopher Kelly, a historian and renowned writer of a number of books like An Adventure in 1914, All the Countries the Americans Have Ever Invaded, and soon, The America Invades. Christopher, where can somebody go to see your body of work and all the things that you've written about?
Yes, they can find out more about me at my websites at AmericaInvades.com, at ItalyInvades.com, and also at AdventureIn1914.com. This is the title of that book. And then my most recent book, as you mentioned, is going to be called America Invaded, which is going to be a state-by-state guide to fighting on American soil, which will be coming out in the summer of this year.
Definitely looking forward for that. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech. We definitely want to have you back, because we definitely can't evolve without really knowing about where we've been. So history is definitely an important point. It was a pleasure having you on Twitter. Thank you so much for coming.
Happy to do it. Look forward to it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
Of course, we have to thank my co-host, who's also in the tireless, is also our tireless producer of This Week in Enterprise Tech, Mr. Brian Chi. He's the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. And also, he found another job as a runner as a hamster wheel in his laboratory. Cheaper, can you tell the folks at home where they can find your work and maybe the hamster drop cam?
Well, all my cameras are offline. Sigh. I actually have to go back to the campus and go start harvesting power quality meter data. We're trying to figure out whether or not we want to even trust the power that they're put us on right now, and to see if I can figure out what kind of weirdness happened that caused those transformers to blow up. But I want to hear from you, the Twiat Riot. You guys have come up with some amazing show ideas, and I'd like to follow those leads. JJ, thanks. We're still trying to track down that last one. But I'm on Twitter, and that's ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Throw me ideas at Twitter. I'd like to hear from you. And you know what? Let's go see if we can get your show idea on the air next.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brian. That was Mr. Brian Chi, my friend and the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. And if you have any suggestions, like you said, for the topics or guests for This Week in Enterprise Tech, Brian's the producer. He's the man. He gets our guests, and he pretty much is the man, period. So thank you again, Brian. Folks, we also want to thank you. You tune in each week and every week, and we wouldn't be able to do this show without you. So we want you to come back, and we want to make it easier for you to get your enterprise information each week and every week. So just go out to our show page, twit.tv/Twiat, and there you will find all of our back episodes, as well as all the full shows, all the links for our stories during the show, as well as the name of our guests. It's pretty much a very useful place to go for getting topics we went over. And more importantly, next to the videos over there on the right there, there's these magic buttons, and they allow you to subscribe to the format of your choice, audio, video, HD video, and of course to the device of your choice, whether it's phone, tablet, laptop, desktop. And also, don't be afraid to share Twiat with your friends and family who want to learn about tech around the world and this week, and as well as listen to This Week at Enterprise Tech. Don't forget, you can follow me on twitter.com/LilMM, where you can find all my cool things that I'm working on. And don't forget to visit graph.microsoft.com to check out the new Microsoft Graph, where you can do all these cool things that I talked about today, as well as head over to aka.ms/GE, which is the demo of the Graph Explorer and how cool it is to have your information at your fingertips. But I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. To the engineers, especially to the engineers at Twit there, and especially to Leo Lisa, who allows us to and supports us each week to continue doing This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. And of course, thank you to our TDE, Kevin, the man himself. Kevin, can you tell the folks at home what it is that you do here?
Hi, I'm Kevin. I teach people about sharks, and I TD and edit sometimes.
Fantastic.
Hi, Patrick.
The sharks, definitely.
Hi, Patrick. What are you doing?
Okay. All right. Good to see you. Thanks, Kevin. Well, folks, until next time, I am Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.